It's better over here.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 9:21, and our next guest is a regular voice here on Total Information AM, also a regular voice on CBS Radio, weighing in on military and geopolitical incidents worldwide. He is Colonel Jeff McCausland, the CBS News military analyst, and he's going to stay with us for several segments this morning. A great opportunity to chat with Jeff. Welcome back to Studio B.
Hey, it's always a great pleasure to be with you guys here in St. Louis.
Well, since we had a little time with you, we often just bring you in to talk about issues, but we want to know a little bit more first about your career. We always say retired U.S. Army colonel. Tell us a little bit about where you were, what you did.
Yeah. Well, the whole story begins for me back here in the great state of Illinois, just north of here. I was born and raised in central Illinois. I graduated from high school in a small high school called Beardstown, Illinois. It's about 90 miles due north of the St. Louis metropolitan area. Upon graduation, we received a nomination to go to the United States Military Academy at West Point. So I went to West Point, graduated from there, and then began my military service, which as a requirement, being a graduate, is at least 5 years. So off to Europe I went because, of course, that was the Cold War. That was 1968. And over the course of a number of years, probably spent 12 to 14 years in Europe and Germany primarily as an artillery guy. Later in that particular career, as I stayed in the Army, I became a battalion commander in Germany at the very end of the Cold War, and we were deployed to Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm in Saudi Arabia in 1990 and 91. And my battalion was part of the lead attack force into Iraq, if you remember that a long time ago, as part of that big 7th Corps left hook, and so we ended up in Iraq and Kuwait and then back in Iraq. And then we redeployed at the end of the war back to Germany, and then I moved the battalion back to the United States. Following that, I ended up on the faculty of the United States Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where we still live to this very day, but was pulled down and spent time working in the White House on the National Security Council staff, and arrived there just in time for the Kosovo crisis in 1999. So I went through Kosovo and spent some time in the 90s in Kosovo, spent some time in Bosnia, spent some time in El Salvador. You may recall the big civil war going on in El Salvador. Spent some time in all those places. And then after I retired from the Army in 2002, we remained in Pennsylvania. And initially, I was the chair of leadership education at the Naval Academy before returning to where I live in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, to run a leadership program at Dickinson College in Carlisle, where I have been to this very day. Along with teaching at times at Penn State University and the Penn State Law School. And subsequently in 2003, got that phone call out of the blue from CBS asking me if I would be an analyst for what appeared to be and turned out to be the invasion of Iraq once again. And that was supposed to be a temporary position. Well, that temporary position with CBS has now gone on for 21 years.
That is an incredible career.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Here in St. Louis, I got to do a quick shout out to visit my brother Dave and his lovely wife Kim, and my brother Jim and his lovely wife Jan, and my nieces Julie and Jennifer. And so we're going to do that. And then to kind of harass you guys, I'm heading out of here tomorrow to go to Chicago because, and you know this, I'm a Chicago Cubs fan. And so I'll spend the weekend in Chicago seeing the Cubs play the Yankees.
I do know that you're a Cubs fan. You rolled in here wearing a Cubs hat, I should note. But it is always an honor to talk to you. And spending so much time in education, certainly you've had the pulse of the changes of the military, the evolution of the military over the years. What stands out to you?
Well, the big change, of course, at the very onset was the draft. I mean, one reason why I ended up going to West Point was back in 1968. If you were a young man, you were going to go in the military in some form. And I decided, I thought a military career might be interesting. It turned out it was. And number two, I was going to go in the military in some way, so I figured I better do it under my terms as opposed to the government's terms. And, of course, you know, the cost of a good education at West Point was free, which made it very, very attractive. So the end of conscription back in 1973, and so I served for a short period of time after I was commissioned in a conscription draft-based army. And that's very interesting now that I teach college to talk to young people today and try to explain to them conscription. You might as well explain to them what it's like to be a Martian. I mean, it's just almost impossible for them to conceive the government would send you a postcard, which is what it was, and you'd end up in Vietnam, which is what happened back in those days. So that was a big change. The second big change, of course, was the integration of women. That occurred in the mid-80s. Women began to arrive at the military academy at West Point, the Naval Academy, Air Force Academy, and all those places. And about 20 to 25% now of the U.S. military are women. And something which is a total plus as far as I can see because of the outstanding talent these fine young women bring to all the different combat specialties. And they now can serve in any combat specialty. So that has been a big change. And then finally, of course, it is a professional force. We don't conscript people anymore. And as time has gone on and we've gone through, of course, a very difficult 20 years. I mean, think about a youngster who was born in 2000 until the withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, he or she's whole life, we'd been at war. We were at war for two decades, okay? Again, conscription wasn't there, so it didn't necessarily affect people socially, but an awful lot of people went. I lost a nephew who was injured in Afghanistan and subsequently passed away. So now the whole attitude of the population towards the military has changed. When I was initially joined the military, we were scorned by the American people. I mean, people may find it amazing, but I can remember being spit on by the American people and having garbage thrown at me back during the Vietnam War. And then, of course, the military after the Gulf War became in very, very high esteem. And it's still recognized in high esteem by the American public. But the military today is having a challenge, and that is, how do you attract high-quality young people, which is what you need for the military of today? And the military of today has to be one in which people are very well educated due to the sophisticated weaponry. I mean, my goodness, back in 1972, I guess I can tell this now, I can remember my first driver, and I said to him, how in the heck did you ever get in the Army? And he looked at me and he said, well, sir, the judge in Texas said Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, or the Texas State Penitentiary. Well, those things happened then. They can't happen now for a host of legal reasons. And frankly, he wouldn't be able to qualify based on, frankly, IQ, intellect, education, to be a person in the military today. So we've got to figure out some way to convince youngsters in America that giving back to society is an important thing, being part of something that's bigger than they are for some period of their life, not necessarily for a career like me, but for some period of life, is something I think we've got to do a better job imparting to.
Yeah, I would say back when you joined the Army, most people in this country had some connection to the military. And today, I would say most of us don't have any connection to the military.
That's exactly right. I mean, of course, my generation, we were the sons and daughters of the World War II generation. My father served in World War II. My uncle served in World War II. And one uncle served in the Korean War. So that we were the next generation from that. And because of conscription, I used to say you could go into any household in America, and if they had a son, somewhere in the household, in the living room or hanging on a wall, you'd see a picture of this young man in a military uniform, and that was the picture that was taken of him on the day he graduated from basic training. They were always there, Marine, Army, Navy, whatever, but there was a picture of him coming out of basic training. Now, the vast majority only served for 2 or 3 years, their requirement, and then returned home or wherever they're going to do to pursue their, you know, life's pursuits. But yeah, there was that close connection to the military, and that has dropped away as the military force has gotten smaller, and we've become a more professional force.
It is 9:30. We're going to take a break and come back with more. Colonel Jeff McCausland with us in studio on KMOX right after this. It's
better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
For the past 3 seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a 4th season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 9:36, and we are back for more with our CBS military analyst, Jeff McCausland. It was so interesting learning more about his career and what he's done, but now we get to the business portion, Jeff, because there is a lot going on in the world. And big in the news, obviously, this week has been the latest in Israel and Gaza. There are Israelis who are protesting, wanting a ceasefire. 6 hostages died. Benjamin Netanyahu says he's going to keep going. But what is the end game? I mean, how does it end?
I think this has been the criticism of Mr. Netanyahu's government and his personal policy since this war began. You know, I spent a lot of time in Washington. I think I mentioned early on, I worked in the White House. I worked in the Pentagon. We used to say in Washington, the one question that's most infrequently asked is, and then what? What do you do the day after? The application of military force is not an end. It's a means to an end to shape an environment that hopefully then leads to greater peace and longer-term stability. That's why you use military force. And throughout this conflict, Mr. Netanyahu has totally avoided that, even though he's been urged to talk about that by the Biden administration and other allies around the world. What are you going to do once this is over? Even if you are successful militarily, what are you going to do? Who are you going to turn this over to? An international force? Palestinian Authority, which you have made every effort, frankly, to undercut over the years? Or are you going to occupy it? Well, you can occupy it, and the Israelis did occupy the Gaza Strip until 2005. Our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, rough ratio that we would talk about was about 2,000 soldiers per 100,000 to control a population. Well, if you do the math and you got 2.2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, that comes out to about 40 or 50,000 soldiers whose only mission is controlling a piece of ground that's about 25 miles long and about 15 miles wide. So 1/3 of your active army will be doing nothing but occupying that. Not making it better, just keeping a lid on it. On into the future indefinitely. And I spent a lot of time, lived in the United Kingdom twice during what they referred to as the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And I once asked a British colonel, because of the large percentage of the British Army that was in the occupation of Northern Ireland, in the early 90s, I asked this guy, I said, okay, you've now been in Northern Ireland for over 20 years. What have you accomplished? And he looked at me and he said, we have an acceptable level of violence. That's all we have.
Acceptable level
of violence, okay? So in the aftermath, even if the war were to end today, and it seems the fighting is dying down somewhat, though there are still attacks by Hamas in the Gaza Strip, there are 40,000 dead plus Palestinians. The Israeli military acknowledges, they say publicly, that they believe they've killed 15,000 Hamas fighters. Okay, I wasn't a math major, but if you acknowledge 40,000 people are dead and 15,000 were Hamas fighters, that means 25,000 people were somebody else. A lot of those were civilians, clearly, men, women, children, elderly, and about 94,000 Palestinians have been injured. The entire area is devastated, no fresh water, no really functioning medical system, roads destroyed, 70-80% of all buildings destroyed or at least damaged. So what do you do with this in the aftermath? And Mr. Netanyahu really has not addressed that and has argued from the beginning that he had 2 objectives. One was the total destruction of Hamas militarily and politically, and the second was the freeing of the hostages. But clearly those 2 objectives are in contradiction. You know, you can't get to one without the other. And now he's hung his hat on this narrow strip of land called the Philadelphia Corridor, which is basically the border between Gaza and Egypt, saying that the Israeli military must control that. It's 8 miles long and 100 yards wide. We have to control that to stem off the smuggling of weapons by Hamas back into Gaza. And until they agree to that, there'll be no ceasefire. Well, they're never going to agree to that. So in essence, you, I think, unfortunately, are putting those 70 remaining living hostages, we believe, in jeopardy. And even his defense minister has pretty much publicly come out and opposed to that.
What is Iran's status in all of this?
Well, Iran, I think right now is in a bit of turbulence. One, they got a brand new president, a guy named Pezeshkian. He was recently elected after their prior president was killed in a helicopter accident. He seems and even campaigned on issues of trying to find some way to negotiate with the West, even over nuclear weapons. He actually talked about that. And the Grand Ayatollah, curiously enough, in the last couple of weeks said, yeah, it's okay to negotiate with an adversary, which is rather odd. So there have been some feelers or indications that they might want to negotiate. Is that just atmospherics or false? Who knows? On the other hand, of course, you had this guy by the name of Ismail Haniyeh. I mean, Ismail Haniyeh was a Palestinian. He was the head of the political section of Hamas. And he attended the inauguration of the new Iranian president in Tehran. The next day, and he was on the dais, and there's pictures of him embracing the new president shortly after the inauguration, all that kind of stuff. So the next day, next morning, about 12 hours later, he was staying in a house in downtown Tehran that was controlled by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Force, their most elite military. And suddenly that house blew up, killing him and his guard force, okay? Now, Israel has never claimed responsibility for that attack, but most, if not all, people believe the Israelis did that, which was sort of, you know, a real, you know, sick in your finger in the Iranians' eyes. And so the Iranians have said, we will respond in some fashion at a time and place of our choosing. And recall, of course, that in April, in response to the killing of a couple of IRGC generals in Syria, Iran did do a massive attack against Israel, launching about 300 cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and drones against Israel. That attack was largely thwarted by the Israelis, with the United States support and other British and other support. Only a few of them got through. I think, sadly, one Arab girl was killed. That was about the only injury. But there is a real possibility of a major attack by Iran. And then there's the worry that has really been part and parcel of this war since it began, that things could get out of control and you can move from a war that's isolated primarily in Gaza to a broader regional war that could stretch literally from the Mediterranean Sea all the way to Iran. Mm-hmm. And that has been the worry. And as things go on, back to this, what are you going to do next? I mean, really, by my read, the Israelis are involved in about five wars right now. They're involved in a war in Gaza against Hamas. They're involved in pretty much a war with Hezbollah, which is a much more powerful military force in southern Lebanon. And they just did a big attack and counterattack between the two of those. They're in a war with the Houthis down in Yemen, who keep firing missiles at them and firing missiles at ships to slow the commerce through the Red Sea. There's this major threat by Iran, which could lead to a major war. And if that's not bad enough, in the last week or so, the Israelis have launched several major military operations onto the West Bank. Because remember, the West Bank is occupied territory, and there's 3 million Palestinians living on the West Bank. So they attacked several towns on the West Bank, killed 30 or 40 people, have now detained over the course of the war on the West Bank 5,000, 6,000 people in jail. And there's a real possibility of an uprising on the West Bank as well. But in the midst of all that, the same government by Netanyahu has done what? Well, he's expanded the number of settlements on the West Bank in the middle of this war. And he has, through his ministers, changed the rules whereby Israelis, conservative Israeli Jews, are allowed to pray on Temple Mount, which is where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is in central Jerusalem. Those things, while you can argue whether they're right and wrong, are enormously provocative right now. And like I said, you already got four or five wars. Why do you need another one?
That is a lot.
On your plate. And if I was a military guy talking to my political leadership in Israel, I'd say, we got a resource problem. if we don't figure this out pretty soon.
Do we have time for one more here before?
Yeah, yeah. Of course.
Well, I did want to ask about Ukraine because they are still hanging in there. They've had some good days. I remember when this whole thing first started, when Russia first started invading, it seemed like everybody in the United States was pro-Ukraine. It's since become almost a partisan issue, and we have held back on supporting Ukraine. What do you think is the latest? Are we still holding them back? Do they need our help?
They certainly need our help, without question. In the last couple of days, we've seen a rain of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones on Ukrainian cities. I believe the city of Lviv was hit in a large attack. About 50 people were killed. About 200 were injured. And the Russians now are not really even making any attempt, I think, to disguise that they are focusing their attacks on residential areas. This was an apartment house. There was pictures I've seen of a guy, his wife, and three kids, three little girls. I'd say about 10, 8, and about 4. Well, he was the only one who survived in that family. Their apartment was hit. Everybody else was killed but him. Okay? So that's what's going with the effort on the part of, I think, the Russians to, if you will, destroy the willpower of the Ukrainian people. As a consequence, they have called upon us and NATO members to provide them more air defense weapons. We provided some F-16s, were important in that regard, but they need more to defend them there. They are conducting a ground offensive into Kursk, which is actually part of Russia, and they occupy several hundred square miles of Russian territory. But at the same time, in the southeastern part of the country, the Russians are making steadily advances towards a city called Poltava, which is important because it's a major logistical hub. But along the way, the Russians right now are losing about 1,000 casualties every single day.
Wow.
Dead, wounded, missing, captured, never seen again. Mr. Putin's strategy, to me, is very clear. In fact, Debbie, what you said about the politics of this, his end date is the American election because he thinks his willpower is stronger than ours, stronger than our NATO partners. And if he can keep that going, and Mr. Trump, frankly, is elected, it's pretty clear Mr. Trump has been opposed to military aid to Ukraine. His running mate, J.D. Vance, is the most outspoken opponent in the Senate of military aid, and frankly has been candidly quite skeptical of NATO, and many of his former senior advisors say that if he's reelected, he'll pull us out of NATO. Well, if you're Putin, you say, keep this going until then. This guy wins. I got what I want. So he's playing that game long. And then last but not least, I just can't understand when you think about the amount of money we've provided Ukraine, which is not insignificant, about $100 billion or more. People deride our European allies for not doing enough, and they should do more. But if you look at the numbers in terms of overall aid, economic, humanitarian, as well as military, they're about where we are, frankly. But there seems to me three reasons you would consider this. One is moral. I mean, the Russians have committed war crimes. One attack, they hit a child's hospital, a maternity hospital, and a cancer ward in one missile attack. So from a values standpoint, it would seem to me, or a morality standpoint, it seemed to me we should support them. From a value standpoint, freedom, justice, democracy, Ukraine's an imperfect democracy, so are we. Frankly, the Ukrainian democracy is probably as good in terms of democratic terms as some of our allies, some of our Eastern European allies, Turkey perhaps, if you look at how that's run democratically. But finally, I always point to people from a geopolitics side. I always quote the Japanese prime minister who was standing in the streets in Kyiv with Mr. Zelensky, and he said, if you want to deter Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific, you've got to win in Ukraine. It's that important. And so for those who say, well, we can't worry about that, that's a problem far, far away. No, all these problems are interconnected. And if you don't think Mr. Xi Jinping is watching carefully how the United States reacts to this, then you're just wrong.
Retired U.S. Army Colonel, CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland, thank you so much. It's great to see you here at KMOX.
My pleasure.
It's better over here. AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
For the past three seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a fourth season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.